CFCs that have been introduced as a substitute for the CFC, you see they have a very much smaller ozone depletion potential, but they still have a large global warming potential. So now the challenge is to find substitutes that at the same time have a small ozone depletion potential and a small global warming potential. That's the actual challenge, to find these kind of substitutes. Shown in another way, this is the evolution of the equivalent of emissions in gigaton of CO2. You all know CO2 is a climate gas, and you can express the effect of the substances, of the ozone depleting substances, also in equivalent, as equivalent to an emission of gigaton of CO2. And you see, this is the curve of the rising emissions of CO2. And this is the curve corresponding to the ozone depletion substances. And if we would not have had the Montreal Protocol, then this curve would have continued to rise, which means that it's the difference we have between what we would have had without the Montreal Protocol and what we have now corresponds to about 11 gigaton equivalent CO2 per year, which is larger, in fact, than the objectives of the Kyoto Protocol for this time period, 2008-2012. So it confirms that this Protocol of Montreal had a very strong, positive, well, beneficial impact on climate change. This is taken from a paper from Paul Newman in 2009, who has calculated what would have been the effect on ozone if we would not have had the Montreal Protocol. So what is the situation that we have avoided? And you see here, as a function of latitude from South Pole to North Pole, the total column of ozone. In 1970, before we had the ozone problem, in 2000, the actual situation, and what we would have had in the coming years if we would not have had the Montreal Protocol. And you see that we would have come down with ozone over the whole globe to about a level of 100 Thompson units. So we really have had a big chance with the Montreal Protocol to improve on this situation. This is a similar simulation for the Arctic and for the Antarctic. Again, you see similar effect. We have avoided a very large decrease of ozone in the coming years. And of course, this has a big effect on UV, because if we would have had this low amount of ozone, we would have really had very high risk of sun exposure in such a situation, and very high UV indexes. What's the situation today, and what do we predict for the future? This is taken from the latest scientific assessment of ozone that will be released in the end of this year. So what does this say? It says that in 2006-2009, the ozone at mid-latitude has not anymore decreased with respect to the previous time periods, but it has not recovered either. So we are still in a leveling off situation where we have 6% lower ozone in the southern hemisphere and 3.5% lower ozone in the northern hemisphere than we had before the ozone problem arose. UV has no more increased since the 1990s. The ozone hole at the poles are similar to what they were in the beginning of the 1990s, but we have, of course, a large variability from year to year. But on average, ozone is 40% lower in October in Antarctica than it was in 1980. It's still 40% lower. And UV in Antarctica is still between 55 and 85% higher than we had before the ozone hole. It has also been verified that the ozone hole in Antarctica has had important changes on surface climate in the southern hemisphere. And at the same time, stratosphere has been cooled by a few degrees Kelvin between 1980 and 1995, but it is now also coming to a steady state level. And these are observations which confirm what I say. This is ozone at a few stations on the world. This is the temperature. You see the decrease and now a kind of stabilization of ozone at all sites on the world. And same for temperature. Temperature has decreased and is now stabilized. And we hope it will recover. What do we forecast for the future? We predict that this is the rise in effective stratospheric chlorine since 1980 without the Montreal Protocol, and with the Montreal Protocol we are on this curve and we see that we come back to the pre-ozone hole levels in about around 2050. And at the poles, it will be somewhat later, it will be around 2065. We expect that ozone at the global level will be recovered to the level of 1980 earlier than 2050 because of the interaction with climate change. We expect that ozone will be recovered at mid-latitude around between 2015 and 2030 in the northern hemisphere and between 2030 and 2040 in the southern hemisphere. And in Antarctica, as I said already, it's somewhat in the middle of the century. And this is earlier than what we think for the decrease of the chlorines, because there is an interaction with climate change which makes that the stratosphere is colder and that ozone will recover faster than we would have had without climate change. And we even think that at the end of this century, ozone will be above the level that it had before the appearance of the ozone hole. Again, because of the interaction with climate change and because of changes in aerosol, in clouds, in SO2, and so on. Now, these are predictions, but there are still quite some uncertainties on this because we don't know exactly how climate change will evolve. We don't know exactly how it will influence the transport in the atmosphere. So it's very important that we continue to measure and to verify what happens to ozone and to the climate change. And an important uncertainty is nitrous oxide. And I will come back to that. It's taken from a paper from Ravin Shankara in Science in 2009. Nitrous oxide is a very well-known greenhouse gas in the troposphere. But when it comes to the stratosphere, it is photolyzed to form NOx. And as we saw before, NOx is an ozone-depleting substance. It has an ozone depletion potential, which is of the same order of magnitude as that of certain HCFC. And the problem with NOx coming from N2O is that it's continuously rising. This is the trend of N2O since 1996 until 2010, and you see a steady increase of about 0.25% per year, which gives you 2% per decade, which is really important. So this means, and this increase is due mainly to agricultural practices and to human activities. And we don't know very well where the sources are of the N2O, so it's very difficult to regulate this and to try to stop this increase. And so if you look at the ozone depletion, the emissions in terms of ozone depletion potential, in 1987, it's the CFC which are really the most alarming emissions. Now in 2008, where we are now, we have banned the emissions of these CFCs, and N2O has become the most important ozone depletion gas, in fact, in the atmosphere. And, as I said, it's continuing to increase. And so here, again, we have a strong link with climate. This is the evolution of the emissions that I told you. N2O is the strongest one at the moment and is still increasing, and at the same time it has a strong climate effect. So this is really a new challenge for the 21st century. We have succeeded in banning the CFCs, but we are now left with a problem with the nitrous oxide. So that's about my story of ozone. Now I just wanted to show you a few contributions that we specifically did at the Institute for Space Aeronomy in Belgium. We have been very active in the production of ozone data records from satellites, from the different European satellites, GOME, GOMOS, KIAMAKI, MIPAS, and so on, and also of their validation. It's very important if you have a satellite with a limited lifetime that you have a high-quality ground-based instrument to verify the continuity of the satellite data series. And so we have been very active in producing ozone data from these satellites and in validating them relative to ground-based data. At the moment, we are leading a project fitting in the ESA Climate Change Initiative, which tries to build an ozone record from satellites over a long period to follow the evolution of ozone and its impact on climate. We are proposing a Belgian satellite to monitor ozone. It's called Altius. Altius is a LIMP sounder targeted to stratospheric, mesospheric ozone profiles and some minor trace gases that have an impact on ozone and that are like the BRO, which I showed you before. This is a picture of how the satellite would look like. We have also done a lot of ground-based measurements in the frame of the network for the detection of atmospheric composition change. This is a map of this network with stations all over the world. And Belgium contributes to this network with a station in the Swiss Alps, a station in the Norway, a station in the south of France, and a station in Réunion Island at the east of Madagascar in the southern hemisphere, where there are very few stations and where it's important to measure tropical effects. And so what we are doing at these stations, we are measuring continuously ozone and the number of chlorinated and brominated species to follow their evolution with time. And this is an example of the series we have been measuring at the Jungfraujoch in the Swiss Alps. I talked very little about numerical modeling at the moment. I just showed you the small film about the ozone hole in the Antarctic. We are producing near real-time analysis of ozone. You can find them on this web page. And this is, for example, a map of ozone column as a function of latitude between beginning of 2007 and 9. And you see, for example, the ozone hole here in... this is the ozone hole in October, and here you see the actual ozone hole developing in October. And so these maps are updated every day, and you can find them on the web. And we also monitor the UV index at a few stations in Belgium and in Luxembourg, and you can find on our webpage the daily UV index to tell you how much you have to protect yourself from the sun when you go out in summer. You can visualize this website and know what is happening. So that's about the end of my story. I think the study of ozone is a quite recent study. It started in 1930, as I showed you, but it has evolved very much in these 50 years since then. And just to show you, this is a Dobson spectrometer. It's the first measurement, the first instrument to measure total ozone in the atmosphere. That was how it looked like in 1930. And that's how we are measuring ozone now, with satellites orbiting around the Earth every day and taking global pictures of ozone, for example. I hope I could convince you that the Montreal Protocol is really a success story. It shows you how there can be a positive impact between the scientists and between the policy makers. And it has, which was not targeted, but which was a side effect, it has had a very positive impact on the reduction of climate change. And as I said to you, ozone research is not finished. We have still challenges ahead of us. We have to verify the forecasted recovery because of the interaction with climate change. There are still a lot of unknowns. We have to verify and to continue to adapt the Montreal Protocol if necessary. I showed you the threat of nitrous oxide on ozone, how to limit this, can we do something against it, what will happen in the troposphere and the mesosphere, and then as a new branch of science, I would say, is geoengineering. People think about putting some aerosols, for example, in the atmosphere to reduce climate change effects, or to put a sail in the space to protect us from UV. So this is very challenging questions which we have to deal with, and I think there's still a lot of work ahead of us, very interesting work to do, and we have to continue to measure to make sure that what we think is right. And so it's not so easy as these people think. We cannot let escape the greenhouse gases through the ozone layer. I think we have to be more inventive to tackle the ozone problem. Thank you.